Hi, everybody. My name is Siobhan Kelly, and I am delighted to welcome you to another episode of the Glass House podcast. So today I have the lovely Caitlin Rudd with me, and she is the head of TA with the Timeout Group. She's based in London, but she does recruit globally. So you're very welcome, Caitlin. Thank you so much
Hello.
For joining us. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
I know this is Caitlin's first podcast, but I know it's not going to be her last. So it's really up to me to make sure that she feels comfortable. And one of the reasons I wanted to get Caitlin on is because she has worked in recruitment and TA. I think it's 10 years now, is it? Maybe a little bit.
Yeah, it's actually probably 12, which is quite depressing. But yeah, it's 12 years. I left uni in 2010. So yeah.
Well, and if you think about it, for those of you who aren't in recruitment, it's like dog years. So 12 years in recruitment is like multiplied by 7 in any other industry. It is like often Game of Thrones. So the reason I wanted to get you on, Caitlin, is because you've worked across a variety of industries. And I think like people who are out there, irrespective of what industry they work in, they don't really understand the processes that recruiters have and like, you know, how the role itself is evolving. I think we spoke the last day just when I was trying to browbeat you into coming onto the podcast. Mm-hmm. And I was saying that when I started in recruitment, I had I suppose a skewed view of what a recruiter was, like a little bit like a snake oil salesman, you know. What did you think of it before you got into it?
Well, I don't think anyone ever educates people on a career in recruitment. It's not one of those things that you know, when you're dressing up as a kid going, what do I want to be when I'm older? You don't dress as a recruiter. So I think it's one of those careers where people naturally fall into it if they are people, and they're happy to have a chat. You've got to be slightly salesy in a way, because you don't make it in a recruitment agency if you're not. But I think really it's being people ambassadors and making sure you're giving people the right direction. And for me, that's what was really important about it, is actually going, you're helping someone find a career in which they're going to spend kind of 80% of their life in. So you might as well make sure you're doing a good job and make sure they're going to be happy doing it.
I couldn't agree more. I used to work with a recruiter in my previous company. This is like right back when I started in 2014, I think it was. And it was when I was kind of, I saw how some of the recruiters were, agency recruiters were, and it was very, very salesy. It was get the fee, like the bum on the seat. And then I remember this one recruiter saying to me, like, you're actually changing lives. And I thought, okay, that I can work with, you know, like that I can kind of like buy into, because when you do get somebody a job, it doesn't just change their life, or, you know, you think about them telling their family or getting dressed for the interview, or, you know, putting the time into research, and all their friends are cheering them on from the sidelines. So once I kind of changed my perspective to look at it like that, it helped. What I will say is that when I started, you mentioned something about salesy. I had to Google what a KPI was, because previously I'd been a flight attendant. How did you navigate the road into kind of, you know, changing lives and helping people, but also, you know, correlating that with making money?
Well, I think it's really easy to do, because if you find the right person for the right role, you're going to make money, but hopefully you're also putting the right person in the right role, because that's what you're there to do. Like you said, I think there are some, you know, slightly older school agencies where it's like, chuck as many CVs as you can and hope one of them sticks, as opposed to it being a more tailored approach. I think that's quite historical recruitment. I think people have changed their tact now in terms of recruiting for best practice, and you'll hear that a lot, and centres of excellence, and making sure that they're really doing impactful work that isn't just about making the money. Because essentially, if you're pairing a candidate and screening that candidate and taking time to understand that candidate and what they want, and you've done the same side on the client side, where you're really speaking to your client saying, hey, what is it you're looking for? Why do you want that? What's really important? What's essential? What's preferable? What is kind of desirable? You know, and really drilling down on what it is they're looking for, not only skills-based, but culturally, then you're going to make money at the end of the day, because you should be doing that on both sides, and therefore matchmaking should be easy.
Yeah, I love that, matchmaking.
Dating was that easy, right?
Oh, no. Don't even, that could be another podcast. what I used to find out, because I would try and explain it to my mom, because initially I did temp contracting or temp recruitment, and I was trying to explain it to her, and she was like, "So you're like selling people?" And it was like, "No, well, yes, but also legally and helping them, you
Yes.
know." So it was trying to explain that. Now, in your career, and one of the things I noticed when I was having a look at your LinkedIn profile, and this is something that a lot of candidates, senior and junior, ask me, so the length of times that they time they spend in a job, and you've had a varied, I love that you're smiling for those of you who are listening to this on Spotify or any of the streaming apps. She is grinning like a Cheshire cat, but that you have had various lengths of contracts. So anything, say, from a year and a half, I think one of the longest was like just under 4 years. Is that right?
Yeah, I think it's probably three, but yeah.
Yeah,
No,
give or take.
I am by no means a sticker rounder. And that's made largely out of choice, thank God. It's not me being got rid of.
Yeah, good luck, Caitlin.
So I grin because there's such a kind of nuance around length of service and tenure in businesses. And again, I think it's shifting slightly because the market has become so much more candidate driven. Candidates are being able to have a bit more of a voice as to what they want, what they expect, be that from kind of a benefits and culture perspective, but also from a, who they want to work for, what kind of businesses they want to work for, with kind of sustainability and CSR and all that starting to become really important to people. Candidates are able to go, actually, I don't like it here, or this doesn't match my values, and I'm going to go somewhere that really ticks all of my boxes, because there are roles out there now that will do that. So I move for two reasons, and that's largely growth and development, where I can continue to do something a bit different and learn new skills or work with different types of people who are going to be quite inspiring. Or it's because the company may or may not have aligned with my values and the way that I work.
Well, you were ahead of the curve in relation to that, and I wish that I had done that. Now, what I will say, and I think there's a lot that people can learn from that, and a lot that employers can learn, because in your LinkedIn headline, one of the words that stood out to me, because English, like, I just can't speak. I haven't finished my first coffee. That stood out to me was retention. So there's a lot of companies that, and I, this is the hill I will die on. They will write on their website that it's like, diversity, equity, inclusion, that like this is a safe space, psychological safety, all of this good stuff. I see companies actually just yesterday being nominated for like best company, and I know what their culture is like. And so when, like, what do candidates do when they look on the website and they read all this stuff, and they can even see these companies being nominated for awards, and then they go in and they've been sold a lemon. Like,
Yeah.
do you think that it's worth them staying for a while to see if they can change it, or?
I did. Culture isn't something you can ever change overnight, and it's always evolving. Firstly, and I think also culture changes depending what's going on externally in the world. So we saw that with different movements that were happening externally, and how that then impacts staff and their right to opinions and right to voice. And how do you give people the right space to voice that in a work environment? And I think people have to tread quite carefully still, knowing that it is a work environment. It isn't home. It isn't hanging out with your mates. You've still got to have an element of professionalism. So actually, is airing your political values, in an office the right place to do it? Maybe not, maybe it is. Depends on the culture of the business. And again, that goes back to how does it sit with you from a comfortability perspective in terms of your own values. So I think it's an interesting one, because culture, as I said, culture isn't ever going to change overnight. It's always a work in progress. There's always things that you can look at, adapt, readapt, reinvigorate. A lot of companies use websites and blurbs as slight tick box exercises, because they know what candidates are looking for. Yeah, we value, DE&I. Yes, we look for candidates from different backgrounds. Yes, we're willing to do this and this and this. And actually, my thing is to just, when you get to a final stage interview, actually drill them on what that means. What are they doing? Because it's very easy to say all this stuff, and most companies are saying it. And it's, I say stuff, but it's important stuff. But actually, unless you're really drilling into what they're doing around it, do they have employee networks where they're supporting different types of candidates and culture? Do they have partnerships externally with DE&I networks? So, they really are making a conscious effort to partner. What are they doing from a recruitment perspective to make sure that your process is as fair and equal as possible, regardless if you are have a disability, be that mental or physical? So I think you can pick up on all of these things through an interview process. But if you're not getting what you want and you want to triple check that they're gonna, as I said, match kind of your core values and that they are what they say on the tin, I think as an interviewer, I like being asked what we're doing because I think, hey, they're taking a real interest in us as a business.
Yeah, no,
So.
I completely agree. I also think though as well that, I mean, it's something to keep in mind is when you are having an interview process with a company that you can go on to LinkedIn and have a look at their current staff and see like, how it's broken up. Also if people have been promoted in the roles that they're in, so what like their growth plans are. And I remember speaking to an EA a few weeks ago and with an executive assistant, for example, like it's one of those roles where the person that they're supporting really has a direct effect on how successful they're going to be in their job just purely because of a communication,
Course,
for,
yeah.
yeah. So if they don't tell them what they need to do, then the EA is like, their arms are tied behind their back. But I was saying, I think it was at the forum that we did, and it was I was saying like you can ask questions like, is this a new role? What were the touch points between and the faces? And these are like senior executive assistants, like 50, 60, 70K per year. And they're like, can you ask that? And it's like, yes, you
I
have
know
to.
everyone's so polite and I get it, but also like you want to like how long has the role been open for? Why haven't you found the right candidate? What haven't people had that you're really looking for? I'm a huge ambassador of the more questions people ask, the more interested they're in, but also the more honest a conversation you're going to have.
Yeah, no, 100%. And is there anything like any lessons that you've learned in the roles that you've had? I mean, because it's great for people who are listening to this to know that like not only are you entitled to ask a question, you really should because it is your life at the end of the day. So to I suppose avoid kind of going in somewhere and then leaving, it's the 6 months that you might spend somewhere where it's not a cultural fit. It can start to give you burnout if it's not. If it's a little bit toxic for you, it doesn't mean it's a toxic place, but like maybe it doesn't fit with your core values. That really it's imperative that they ask those questions in it. But is there anything else that you've kind of learned over your 12 years of experience in recruitment that you think would be useful for people to hear in relation to kind of like backing yourself or leadership lessons?
I think we've touched on it, but I think that communication piece and being not being insular when something's going wrong. And I think we're always really quick to blame ourselves if something isn't going right or we're feeling overwhelmed. And I still get that now. I'm like, oh God, there's too much going on. I don't know who to speak to because I don't want it to make me look like I don't know what I'm doing or I haven't been prepared or I haven't kind of pre-forecast that this is going to happen. And so over. And it's probably more recently than not that I've started going, actually, it's okay to put my hands up and go, guys, I'm really struggling here. Like I could do with some more support from leadership, or I could do with some more support from a team, or actually I need to rope in more people to get this done. Whereas before, I think we really, as you said, you sit, you kind of burn out, you start getting more and more stressed, more and more anxious. And people kind of just think that that's normal. And also, no one else around you knows it's going on because it really is in your head. So for me, I've definitely become, I guess, slightly more mature in my approach to going, I reckon my CEO feels like this some days. I reckon my boss feels like this some days. I reckon an account exec feels like this some days, and everyone's on the same page. So actually, just by saying, hey, actually, not okay today. I'm really, really struggling. I feel a bit lost. What should I do? Or could you give me some direction as opposed to a solution? Because we know they don't say, don't come to us with a problem, come to us with a
No.
solution. And actually, sometimes you do have a problem and go, can you just help me work through, can we talk through this?
Yeah, you just want to bounce it off somebody else.
And a lot of time, I think it's very easy to sit, get stressed, and not be able to see the wood through the trees. But I think over time, you learn that actually everyone at every level in any business gets to the point where, like, I'm stuck.
Yeah.
and I need support.
You know, I've spoken to a lot of people for this podcast, and one of the main things, like, I mean, people who are leaders in their field, like you, and one of the common strengths that I've seen, or common traits, I would say, that they all seem to share is vulnerability. You know, that they're not, you know, these are like leaders, you know, like they may not have the CEO title, but they get the buy-in from the people around them, you know, and people follow them because they respect their decision-making process and things like that. And I think, I mean, like, I think it's becoming less and less now because of like the aftermath of COVID and things like that. At the start of COVID, I used to see hashtags like business as usual, and I was nearly pulling my hair out because I was like, it's not. Like, you know, we're watching the news, it's 800, 900 people dying a day. Like, you know, in another country, please stop saying business as usual. Like, people were having, you know, this was after the sourdough thing where everybody thought we would just be home for a couple of weeks. But yeah, one of the things that I thought, and what I found even with people engaging with me on LinkedIn or clients, is like when I was saying that I was finding it challenging and I was finding it isolating, and even starting a business, that it didn't feel like, you know, I really didn't know what I was doing day in, day out, that more people reached out to me. Like, and the fact that you've said that, I think is a standout thing. Is, has there been any great leaders in your life that, like, I suppose, displayed a trait? It could be including vulnerability, or is there another trait you would associate with leadership that you've witnessed?
I've worked for a real range of people, and men, women in HR, and I think that's really interesting in itself because they have very, very different styles of leading. Just if you take it back to like very core male, female ways of leading, they are different. But I think that the key thing that they've all had that I think has made doing my job easy and been able to progress is transparency. And I think vulnerability and transparency go hand in hand because it's just essentially being as honest and as you can be. Not, and again, it doesn't have to just be about work stuff. This can be about stuff that's going on at home that is going to impact your work. You're seeing more and more policies in business around the menopause, miscarriages, and this is stuff that was never really spoken about until probably the past 5 years. Me, I reckon my first policy that I ever saw that was through the menopause or miscarriages in work surrounding women's health was probably about 5 years ago. And if you think about what those things are and do to people, you are never going to go into work and be the same person the next day. Like, because it changes your mentality, it changes your anxiety levels, it changes your stress levels, your distraction. So I think by being transparent and being able to have those conversations, but also by working for a company that is transparent in its approach to those kind of situations, allows you to be, again, really authentic. And the best bosses I've worked for are transparent and authentic and vulnerable because they appreciate these life things that impact work.
Well, I think that's really the key word, isn't it? It's like being authentic. It's not a one size fits all thing for leadership. One of the things that I noticed as well, I was at a conference and it was about women in leadership, and I just seen that picture. I don't know if you saw it, went viral, of all the world leaders, and there wasn't like a one woman in it in each. Like, oh, you know. All right, moving that aside, I do think the corporate world is like getting a little bit better, but the thing for me with leadership, and I think women get a bad rap on this, is that sometimes when a woman would say something, it's like, you know, oh, you know, she's bitchy, or she's bossy, or she, like, you know,
Or it's a motive. I hate that. Stop being so
yeah,
emotive. Oh, what do you mean?
hysterical,
Everything's an emotion.
hysterical. I don't know how they can say that after Trump, you know, but anyway, yeah, so the woman is hysterical, or she's this, or, you know. And then when a man says it, and female employees say this about women leaders as well, you know, so, and but then if a man says the same thing, he's just assertive, you know, and he's just doing his job. Have you ever witnessed that, or do you ever worry about that now that you're going to be like leading a team? And
Haven't witnessed it, and I think I'm probably quite lucky, but being working in the creative industries, particularly, which is largely my background, is I think we're quite forward thinking as an industry. So in general, when it came to male female leadership, I actually always had a relatively equal leadership team. I'm not saying they were hugely diverse, but when it came to like male and female, it was pretty good. And I think that's healthy because you get the balance. I still think there is a historical cultural thing where women struggle to be more assertive when there are men on boards or in those leadership positions. So I think it still happens. I'm lucky that I haven't seen it as much. But I'm all for calling people out. If you see something that you don't think is right, you can't get fired for having an opinion. This is my view. You know, I mean,
You can.
I said you can, but if it's, you know, derogatory or elite, whatever, I'm talking about you cannot be fired for having an opinion about how something isn't working for you within business, because essentially it's just you sharing your thoughts. And if you can say, have you thought about doing something differently, or have you thought about how that might sound to someone else who isn't in your position or isn't in a position of influence? Actually, sometimes these people do need to be called out because times are changing and they're going to need to adapt styles and working with different types of people. So I'm a massive ambassador of, you know, speaking your mind to a degree whilst obviously maintaining integrity and politeness
Yeah, I agree.
and respect, you know,
Yeah,
respect
I
for.
think you can say anything. It just depends on how you say it. I
Yeah.
remember working with like there was a in one of the companies I worked for, there was like a lot of senior women. And to be honest, like you would get some people who would say things about them or whatever, but I remember just looking at most of them in awe because you'd see them like I mean, and I know men obviously have children as well, but you'd see them like with their, with their kids at home. Like one woman, I remember I couldn't speak around her for the first 6 months that I worked with her because she was just, one of these people that like they make you stand up straighter.
Yeah.
When they walk into a room, like she was just like a force of nature, and she could 100% rip you a new one, but she knew what she was talking about, if that makes sense. Like sometimes when she'd come in, I'd want to have like a pen and paper. So if she said something to me, sometimes her delivery would be off, but I always tried to like take the message, if
Yeah.
that makes sense, because I was like, she's seen it, done it, been through it. And it wasn't that she was being rude, she was just like short of time.
And I think that's the thing, isn't it? It's judging these situations and trying, again, not to take everything to heart. I still get really curt, like Google messages, you know, Google chats or emails. And I go, oh my God, I feel like I've done something wrong. And I absolutely hate it, particularly if it's coming from someone more senior, because I just feel, and then I go, oh, I did that yesterday. You know, I just whizzed off an email without thinking, and I got an email back saying, are you okay? Are we okay? And I'm like, oh my God, absolutely fine. But
Yeah.
you forget how, but it's really interesting, isn't it? It's that don't put meetings in people's diaries if you haven't given them the heads up, because they go, oh, what have I done wrong? That's our first instinct, is if they just see a meet, you know, a meeting going.
But I do think sometimes that's done purposely. So, because on the one hand, of this person that I've worked with, and they were just like short on time, super busy, really effective. There was like another manager who you'd go in at 8:30 in the morning and they'd put something in your diary for 4:30.
Ugh.
And like I can't work like that because and I knew that it would be something, because I would even know that they wouldn't say hi, Siobhan, they would just say Siobhan. I'm like, oh, like
Yeah.
dear Lord, and then there was a difference between somebody trying to coach you but doing it in a really direct manner or like, give you a lesson. Than someone who is like scrutinizing what you're doing. Because I've found with some managers are the most effective leaders, they tell you how they do a thing. So if they're training you, but then they let you put your own spin on it, where there was like a couple of managers in there, they wanted you to be a carbon copy of them. And I don't think that that's, like, I'd love your opinion on it. I don't think that's growth leadership. I think that's just management, and there's a difference between it.
It's, yeah, it goes back to all that weird kind of, you know, unconscious bias training that people are doing, where people tend to hire and train people like they themselves were trained and how they react to certain situations. And we know that that is never going to create creativity or you know, different thinking, and building business, because that's that is not diversity of thought. So you've got to be really, again, it's like the self-awareness and this thoughtfulness that's really come into practice, I think, as a recruiter, as a, you know, a leader, is what are we doing to ensure that we're giving everyone the best opportunity to be their best selves? And I hate that phrase because it sounds so wanky, but you know what I mean? Like, you can't hire everyone who looks, sounds, has the same background, is going to train the same way that you train, whatever it may be related to, because you're never going to have anyone that challenges you or makes you think differently or makes you think, oh, we could have done that so differently and more efficiently. So I try really hard to implement, you know, as many kind of bias defeating assessments and tools into everything that I do, whether that's like structured interviews, whether that's blind CVs, which everyone says they do, but do they actually do it? Because it's really hard to do. So again, these are questions that I would ask people if you're interested in business and how they run it. But did I just go really off topic?
No. Okay. No, you're completely still on topic, but you did bring up another interesting point in relation to bias, and I've seen it in a lot of companies. I won't name the company, but I worked a role for this client, and they're no longer a client, but I worked a role for this client, and I'm not even going to say the industry that they're in, okay, but it was just like a nice mid-level administrative role, okay, so filled it, and then 4 months later it didn't work out. So normally the rebate period would be 3 months, but I'd mm-hmm. always like, I'm not like, you know, one and done, so I'd be very much like, I want to partner with the client. So I was like, okay, let's look at what didn't work and I'll refill it, right? So I'm not going to rebill you. So it was a small enough company, and then I was,
did they find out they had tattoos?
Can you imagine? I know, look, the recruiter would be sacked. But I sent them other candidates, right? Highly skilled candidates. And it was, well, you know, they didn't want somebody with an accent and they didn't want this. And when I sent them one person, the question was, well, where are they from? What did they sound like? And I just thought, you know what? I can't, in good conscience, send a candidate to work there.
Yeah.
So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take a hit on the fee. I'm going to give you like a little bit of a refund and then go forth and fill the role with people who look exactly like you. Like, I think at one stage the person said to me, if you can get somebody maybe who's just from the area and is quite an affluent area and who has no experience, you know, like maybe their parents work around here. And I'm like, so like, even though I'm giving you these skilled people,
yeah,
and this and that, and that's like, that's in 2022 in Ireland, you know, and on this website, it's like diversity, equity, inclusion.
Yeah.
I just thought,
it happens. It still happens everywhere. It drives me nuts. And also I think it puts anyone in HR or recruitment in really difficult situations, because as you said, like if you're in-house like me, then there are certain businesses that I've worked for where hiring managers have requested certain things.
Yeah.
Like there are no two ways about it. And I can challenge them and say, maybe we should think about this slightly differently, or, you know, we're living in different times. And also not everyone, you know, different people can offer different skills and it obviously hasn't been working. So, and you will still try and send the most diverse of shortlists or speak them through candidates and say, look, they might not have like for like experience, or they might not have been to university. Another one that comes up, right? And they will still go with the CVs that they think mirror their own experience or probably mirror other people in the team, because it feels safe. And I think people they don't want to take risk. And that comes down to one, being really busy, two, having pressure from your boss. But everyone's it's just so boring. You're just going to end up working for companies that look like they just hire little robots.
No, 100%. And look, I'm glad. I think it's important as well to address that, because I did see on LinkedIn, well, I'm always getting into Twitter fights or LinkedIn fights or something like that, because I just can't keep my big mouth shut. But there was a hiring manager, I won't shame him either, but he was giving out about the use of pronouns. And why are we using them? And he said if he saw anybody, and this is like a North American company, if he saw anybody applying who had pronouns on their LinkedIn, they would automatically be disqualified. And I think it's important as well to remember that, like, we are, some for a lot of the times, whether it's an agency recruiter or an in-house recruiter, we can be the block to a diverse number of candidates getting an opportunity to get the job. So it may be that the client, like, the final client isn't biased or things like that, but the recruiter might be,
And who's screening those people? Who's
No
screening
one.
those? It's sadly probably slightly older school leadership teams who don't even consider that.
It's like you have to go and find these candidates where they are. And on one of the LinkedIn posts I'm doing today, I think out of the like 9 placements I've made, say for where are we now? September, October, like only 2 of the candidates had a degree. Like only four of them, their first language was English. Like, but that was still fees for me. They were still 2 of my strongest months. So it's like for recruiters, like not thinking about color. Think about if you want to be, think about the green, think about the money. But these people are like top of their game, just diversify the group that you're trying to attract.
It's yeah, and it's going to take time to change people's mentality, I think, particularly when you've still got the kind of, 60s, 70s born people in leadership roles.
I'd
I'm
say
trying to
that's
think, like,
going to
what
be very
I'm trying to think of what
controversial.
their ages would be, but I didn't want to sound rude. But like, when you've got 50, 60-year-olds still running business who haven't been educated as well as millennials and millennials
Gen
plus in
Z-ers.
terms of D&I, and all this other and all these other initiatives that have come out, and all of these kind of, political equations that have popped out of boxes because of what's been going on in the world. They can still seem, and it's largely unintentional, quite narrow-minded. But that's because that's all they've known growing up in business. Whereas now I think you're seeing younger leaders and leaders who are now in their 30s or late 30s, early 40s, who have had some form of discourse or dialogue around all of these issues that can impact recruitment for the better. So they do start, filtering them down through their team, so people start to hopefully have a slightly different approach.
So what advice would you give to employers? Because you've given like good advice to like people who are looking to change their jobs or what would you give to employers? Because it is a candidate market and people are being more selective. And if they do go in and they feel that like it wasn't like a Ron Seal job, like it doesn't do exactly what it says on the tin, they're leaving. So you've spent all the employers have spent all this time trying to attract talent, they've hired them. They've trained them. Now they're leaving. Like, what do you think that they need to do, even in relation to employer branding, to attract people into them? And this is for like, maybe the companies that wouldn't have huge budgets,
I think it's listen to the people that you've got first and foremost, and the people that have been there and have stayed through what might have been a couple of tricky years. I know it's probably going to be a little bit trickier moving forwards as well, but those staff are your assets. Those are the people that are going to keep the business running. They are the people with intel, and so they're the people that you want to keep happy. So the first thing that any business that I've worked in tends to do when there is tricky times coming, or we've just come out of a tricky time, is do an engagement survey. And those can work brilliantly if you action what's been said, but they're also redundant if you get them and go, oh, I knew they were going to say this, and there's nothing we can do about it. So you do them if you know you can action some of it, or at least if you can share and say, listen, we've heard, we'll do what we can, we can't do everything. But so listening to the staff that you've got, using them as your case studies, use these like amazingly happy, hopefully candidates who have started and moved up and progressed, or candidates just really bloody love what they do from a job perspective. Like, use them as your ambassadors externally, as brand through employer brand programs, whether that's, having them a day in the life of on your kind of life pages, using videos. I think that's always really, because your staff should be your ambassadors. They should be staying because they like where they're working. And then I think the other thing is going back to that kind of authenticity piece. Make sure what you're saying externally represents what's going on internally. Because if you do get questions, you don't want to be caught out. And if you manage to blag it because you can answer people's questions well and they start working for you and they don't see what you've said on your tin, then they will go and it's a cost to the business. It's expensive to hire
Very
people,
expensive.
lose them, and then have to replace them because you always end up replacing at a higher rate. And I think I absolutely, my biggest thing for any business I work in is like, why would you not pay this person? You know, if they are a someone who has shown that they're committed and they're high potential and they're saying, listen, I've not had a pay rise in a year, or I've hit all my KPIs, or I've hit all my objectives. I'm just 10% would make me really comfortable. And they're on, let's say, 30 grand. So you've got to pay them 33 to keep them happy probably for another year. And they go, no, we can't do that at the moment. It's like, you can, because I see that you're hiring people externally.
At a higher rate.
So there's money. But also, if that person goes because you don't reward or recognize them, you're going to have to replace that role at 35 to 37.
You
So
know what I find? You've already, yeah, you've already lost money.
I'm like, it's my biggest bugbear. Like it, the thought process. I'm like, it doesn't make
Your
sense.
facial expression. I hope if anybody is watching this on YouTube that they can come to this moment just to see. Caitlin's
It
facial expression.
literally drives me nuts.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know if this is going on YouTube. I've got a spot.
You can't see it. You can't see it. One of the things that I found as well, when new people come in, I remember I was working, I was a top biller anyway, but I didn't have like healthcare or pension. And I think the way they did it was that when you come in, there wasn't like a set starting salary or things, it was what you could negotiate. And obviously I wasn't coming from like a proper sales background. So I was just like, oh my God, like whatever you want to give me. No, not like that now. And I was just like very grateful. Like, thank you so much for this. And I was billing and always on the leaderboard. And then I remember speaking to somebody who came in who had worked in a bank and had negotiated like a 13K increase on their salary than I had. And I remember thinking, and another person who had joined my team said to me, how do I set up my healthcare? And I was sitting there, you know, your eye starts to twitch. And I was like, oh, I'd maybe just like ask HR or something, because there was three of us sitting at the desk who didn't have healthcare, you know, and like the person hadn't even turned up or taken off their jacket. And oh, it was very, very stressful. But you know, that's how then they started to lose people, because people started to go in-house and it's just like, I'm just not valued, you know,
Look at
I'm
your
not.
current staff before you start doing stuff for new staff as well.
Yeah, it
And
was just
listen, not
bad.
every, it sounds brutal, but sometimes you're happy to let people go of their own accord. Like you might not want to keep them, but and you don't want to go through a process. So therefore, actually, you're probably not going to do anything
Yeah, and
financial or
let
from a
them, yeah.
benefits perspective and go, it's up to you whether you choose to stay or not. But yeah, if you're going to make changes around benefits or salaries, like look after your own first, you
Yeah,
know,
no, it should be accessible, I think,
yeah,
for
it should.
everybody. But it's back to the transparency thing.
Again, you know, I still fight about why can't we post salaries? I am a massive ambassador of posting salaries for roles,
Yeah.
you know. And in agencies, that's pretty standard because you're not working on for the business. You can't really get in, you're not going to have staff coming after you going, hang on, that looks like my role, but I'm paid 10 grand under that, let's say. Whereas when you work on for a business or on in TA in-house, you've got to be very conscious of not posting salaries because actually there is a degree of inequality when it comes to salaries dependent on experience and where people have come from. But again, I'm a bit, let's be honest about that. And as I don't know if you get this, if you don't post salaries, but my again, another bugbear of mine is posting roles where I can't post the salary and I get 200 applications and 90% of them are not even worth looking at because they're either way under or way above. And it's like, if I could post the salary, you'd make from an efficiency perspective, I'd be able to fill a role quicker because I'm not screening people who are
Yeah, either.
outside of a relatively small salary bracket.
Well, I suppose it's a little bit different for me because, like, from an agency perspective, even though I don't necessarily see myself as like an agency recruiter, I can like I would partner with the client. So I would be able to say, like, some clients will say, well, that will be, I'll pay 25 for that. And I'm like, well, good luck. Because, I won't be working at one, and I don't know anybody who would take the role, especially when they have, like, they want, like, I saw a clip yesterday, an 18-year-old with 20 years experience, for 25K. It's like, it's not going to happen, mate. But, like, if you can partner for me with the client and give them advice on, like, where the role would sit, and if we have a salary band, I'll be very clear then when I'm talking to the candidates. I can say, like, say circa 55. Or somebody said to me about a marketing role recently that she would look at 45, but I was like, no, you're too underpaid in your current role, so I'd recommend you be more 52 to, to fit in. So I think I'd have a little bit more leeway than you
100.
necessarily would.
And it actually ends up being easier sometimes for me working in HR, working with agencies on roles, because I know their candidates are probably going to be screened and filtered before, before me having to go through a huge pipeline. So yeah, it's an interesting one, but it goes again, it's that transparency piece. Come, how transparent can you be to make sure? And it's really difficult. Like, it makes it sound like I'm being really like, oh, people need to fix everything. But actually, when there's all the internal bits and moving pieces, and that's financial, that's profit, that's revenues, that's overhead. Like, when you think of all the costs associated to running a business, you do understand why sometimes they just have to go, no, we can't do this at the moment, or we don't have that pot of money for this role. It's we've put it for that. And
Yeah, so
so
it's assigned. Yeah, it's like a chess game. So certain people can see the whole board, whereas sometimes
yeah.
we're just looking at a small thing. What I will say though, as well, in relation to, and I know a lot of candidates would say this to me, like if I say that the salary is like 45 to 65, they're like, how? I'm like, well, you could get somebody who has like 4 or 5 years experience, but they have like great potential to like pick stuff up really quickly. So that's an option. So that's why they'd be at the lower end. Or you could have somebody who's done this job
Yeah.
previously in a competitor, and they're just going to, like, have an almost like seamless entry into the role, like maybe a couple of new systems. So that's why they'd be like, at the higher level. But it's
Yeah.
hard to explain that to people.
And also, it's the, in America, you can't ask anyone's basic salary. You can't ask what they are on currently. So it's what are your expectations? And largely, people are pretty honest and they are fair. And again, like you said, they might have been being really underpaid, and therefore they are going to bump up their expected salary because they know that they've been in a business that had a name, that they've been in for ages, they haven't had the right kind of increases that they were perhaps due. And so I actually like the expect what, what are your
Yeah,
expectations?
that's what I ask.
Because a basic is really dependent on the business that you're in, who you're working for, how long you've been there. Some of the best staff who have got longevity behind them tend to be the worst paid, which is
Yeah.
bizarre because they haven't moved.
Yeah.
And people tend to be on higher salaries because they move jobs every 1, 2 years, and they get an increase on that.
So
Whereas
there's
actually,
almost like a loyalty tax,
it's yeah, it
yeah,
isn't
for
it?
you
It's
staying.
it, and it's bizarre.
Well,
It should be the other way.
it should be the other way around, but I suppose, I mean, if people don't ask, I always say this, I'm sure people are sick of it, like a closed mouth won't get fed. So if you're going to sit there and say, oh, well, I don't want to rock the boat, or I'm not ready to move, then, it's not going to happen for you. I will say, I don't ask people what they're on. I mean, like, if they want to tell me and I can give them a benchmark of whether that's like a good salary or they're just being robbed, I'll say, you can tell me, but what are you looking for? And sometimes this is a bugbear for me, and I don't mean this in a bad way towards candidates, but I'd like to know your thoughts on this. I'd say, what are you looking for? And it's like, well, I don't know, like, what are they offering? And I'm like, well, before you even go on the call, and a tip that I give people is, like, what does it cost you to live? Like, what is your rent every month, your mortgage, your kids' school, your do you want to go to the cinema? What does that cost? Like, what's your shopping per week? How much will it cost you to go on a holiday? Do you want to have savings? So that's how you get what it costs you just to, like, be a human being on this planet with a roof over your head and food
Yeah.
in your belly. And when you have that, then if you need to have, like, take in your taxes or this, that, and then your skills, or whether, you've studied, you have previous experience, that's where you'll get your baseline. I mean, like, a recruiter can give you can give you advice on it, but it depends on the life, the type of life that you're leading as well, you know, and
Yeah.
what your outgoings are. So it's like, I can't tell you. I can tell you what the market will pay you, but like, you know.
Yeah. And again, it's interesting because some people do go in with a really clear kind of bottom line. Like, there's no point showing me roles, that are under 50 grand, and fine, good. At least you know what you need. Whether you're going to get that or not because your experience is right, who knows? But I do think, even like junior candidates still find salary conversations really awkward and negotiations really awkward. And particularly if it's an amazing opportunity for a brand that they really want to work for or someone that they really want to work with. Sometimes there's flex on that as well. So whilst they might be looking for 30, but they're given an opportunity at 27, they're going to actually, that experience is going to be so much more valuable than that additional 3K. I can buy one less bottle of wine a week and be, earning the same. So I think it's one of those funny ones where you might always go in with an idea of what you want, but when you look at the bigger picture of what it's going to give you, who you're going to be working with, where it's going to get you in terms of your, potential career path, you then can you make adjustments based on what's going to be right for you.
Well, everybody's, and this is the thing about like what it is for you personally to like what it costs you. So it's like people's motivators change. You know, like if you're, you know, mid-career and you want to change careers, so you're going to go to something different. Like, so say you've been an account executive and you want to go into recruitment, you may have to take a bit of a hit on your base to change over, but it's more of a sidestep. Or if you're just starting out, you know, and you, as you said, like you get a chance for experience in an industry that you want, then you're going to be like, okay, well, I'll take the, you know, 13 pounds per hour instead of the 15, because in 6 months I'll be this far ahead, you know, and you're
Exactly.
playing like a different type of game.
And maybe doing something you really want to do. So if you're going to make that career change, and I think that is, I do like some coaching and mentoring for people, and the biggest kind of issue that people come to me with is going, I'm really stuck in a rut. I've been doing this for X amount. That could be a year, it could be 10. And they don't know what they want to do next. And it always comes down to quality of life and salary. And whilst they may really want to go become a pop-up kitchen chef, for example, they know that that is one going to be pretty hard graft. And two, they're starting again from scratch with perhaps no hospitality experience. So they're going to have to start at the bottom of the food chain, but they genuinely want to do that, and this career isn't working anymore. So you ask all these kind of probing questions to what's important, what are you looking for, what is going to make you happy, and how are you going to be able to live your life based on doing what you're doing now versus what you might want to be doing in the future. And I think people, as you said, when they start talking through why, what, how, where, and all those questions you would ask, they start being able to make like more sensical decisions.
Yeah. And I also think as well, in relation to the career coaching, it's like, you know, sometimes your next job is not going to be your dream job. I always look at it like booking, like your, you know, if I was to say to you, like, what's your ideal holiday destination? So what you do first is you research where you want to get to. And it's the same with choosing the ideal job. And then if you're booking a holiday, you also have to book the airport you're leaving from. So I correlate that with like where you are exactly. And then you do a gap analysis. So it's like, what am I missing in skills, education, industry? And it's like, okay, I can't jump from here to there, like, you know, straight away, but what's the next best step? You know, so do I take a contract, you know, and maybe do it for 6 months with a slightly lower salary, but it gets me closer to the industry that I need to be in. And you break it down like that. And if you don't look at the huge jump of where you are now, so say like me, and then I wanted to open a pop-up kitchen, I would be like, what step is going to get me a little bit closer to that? Maybe it could be recruiting and hospitality,
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
and then I get more of an understanding of it that way. But I always find like for people, it's like if you want to enough, you will.
I know it, but also it's that not having that mind space, and that, if you're in a full-time job and you're thinking about potentially doing something else, actually having the space to process it is really difficult because 9 to 5 or 9 to 6 or whatever, you're kind of still trying to keep everything ticking over and, you know, being efficient and doing a good job at the business you're in, you then leave and go, oh God, but I don't really want to be doing this. And then you get home and you're tired and you want to go see friends. So I, yeah, it's a tricky one when people are in that shifting pattern.
But what I would say, what I've found is that, like, don't, I mean, someone said to me, don't let perfect get in the way of good. And then also, I do training with these students, like, they've come to Ireland, they're clients actually, and they are looking for work. They do, like, get, you know, work ready, and they could have been, like, some of them are asylum seekers, and they've gotten their visa to work and things like that. And it's like, I always say to them, if it walks like a duck and talks like a duck, you know, generally is a duck. But I mean, like, if you're a writer, surround yourself with writers. So even if you're doing a 9 to 5 and you're in admin or something that maybe isn't, like, you know, filling your soul, LinkedIn is a great resource to start, like, joining groups for people who are in your industry, because that's where, or the industry that you want to be in. So whether it's graphic design or art or things like that, you know, you can start to surround yourself with the people who are in the career that you want to be, because you'll pick up stuff.
And also, you'll figure out if it's right or not. If you start having
That
conversations with people, the amount of times I really want to do this, and then they do it, they go, oh, this is what I thought it was going to be like.
was like me with sports journalism.
Oh, no, I want to go
It was like, I thought I'd be interviewing David Beckham, and it was like 11 a.m. You know, seeing 9-year-olds running around a Sunday morning. I was like, no, this is not for me. Thank you so much for being, like, so
you're so
generous with
welcome.
all your thoughts and ideas and things like that. I think people are really going to get a lot out of it, both employers and employees, and navigating how to get the best out of recruiters and talent acquisition people. But, like, you are, I will say this, that it's refreshing to talk to somebody else who's in recruitment, like, who is so passionate about diversity, equity and inclusion, and giving people, like, easy ways, not easy, but, like, you know, accessible ways to make the employment, I suppose, arena more accessible to everybody. So,
Yeah, absolutely. Just ask questions. Make sure it's right for you as well.
yeah, you should be very proud of yourself. So thank you so much to Caitlin, and I'm
Thank
sure we'll have her back on again.
you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.